Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. Our podcast is brought to you again today by our friends at 8 Sleep. And we have one of our favorite guests back on, who's a podcaster, columnist. You're doing videos and stuff. Matt Lewis from the Daily Beast. So, I mean, like, how do you describe yourself? You're a man of many, many media these days, Matt.
Bon vivant.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed watching your video with Ben Howe. Looking forward to getting him on our podcast as well. So you have a piece that I want to talk about that's right now, as we speak, behind the paywall, but since I pay for it, I've been able to read it. We're falling into a whirlpool of paranoia. And the subhead is, once upon a time, the dueling body count hashtags would have been the territory of people who thought the moon landing was faked. But now the president is promoting this stuff. It is one of those things that I'm sure you struggle with it as well, to go, okay, we've seen this before, all the fake stuff. The president loves conspiracy theories, yada, yada, yada. But wait, no, this is like, is it worse, or does it just feel like it's irreversible? Because we are in this whirlpool of paranoia. Okay, for people who've been vacationing on Mars over the last 48 hours, the President of the United States actually retweeted a conspiracy theory that his friend Jeffrey Epstein had been, may have been murdered by the Clintons. I mean, clearly they screwed it up, but I mean, like, where are we now, Matt?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there are a couple things noteworthy here. One is that Donald Trump is a conspiracy theorist, and he was long before Jeffrey, before this story. I mean, go back to the birthers and everything.
Oh, and Ted Cruz's dad killing JFK.
Yeah, exactly. So that's part of the story. But the other part of my column is really the fact that our elites and institutions have betrayed us. And so, when the story came that this was a suicide, a lot of really smart, serious people, much smarter and more serious than Donald Trump, didn't buy the official line. They said, it's something smells fishy here. And I think part of the reason that you have a lot of, just normal people distrusting the media, distrusting the president, distrusting the criminal justice system is because we've learned to do it. It's a perfectly rational thing to do. Things are really crazy right now.
It is perfectly rational to be completely crazy. That really does describe our moment, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's
the crazy is really rational.
It's bizarre, but I think that our elites and our institutions have failed us and have betrayed us. And one of the consequences of that is they no longer get the benefit of the doubt. And of course, that's a very dangerous thing, because if there ever were a real emergency when they needed to summon us, we probably wouldn't believe them.
Okay, so who are these elites that have failed us, that are somehow responsible for the President of the United States tweeting out paranoid bilge?
Really? Well, look, I want to separate these two things. Yeah. I think Donald Trump is an exceptionally bad person and exceptionally irresponsible. And, I take some swipes at him in this column, and I think deservedly so. But the larger story is that almost all of our institutions have we've lost faith in them. If you go back to around the time of, before Watergate, before the Kennedy assassination, before Vietnam, most Americans trusted most of these institutions. And now, whether it's the Congress or the president or the media, which I think deserves some skepticism, even the Catholic Church, Major League Baseball with the steroid controversy, there really
criminal justice officials, cops.
Here you go. Look at some of the things that we now know because of smartphones that we might not have thought were true in the past.
Well, so what you're saying is that we've become reflexively skeptical of these so-called experts. But of course, that was true, in 2016 or 2015, before this new wave of Trumpism. I mean, there's something has happened. Okay, so there's been a lot of reasons to be skeptical. I mean, we had the government lie about weapons of mass destruction. You had the credibility gap during the Vietnam War. But there was a moment that you and I are both old enough to remember where we kind of knew that the people who said the moon landing was faked were nuts, right? There was a moment when, in polite society, you didn't take the 9/11 truthers seriously. And now we have the President of the United States, though, tweeting out this fever swamp stuff, and it's in the bloodstream.
Yeah.
So
yeah, no, I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think some of it, of course, is the internet, which is a big game changer. One of the consequences of getting rid of gatekeepers is that there's some good things to it, but the fever swamps are now much have a much more of a reach than they used to. But look, I think that Donald Trump, one of his many sins is just that he doesn't. What's the line? I guess it was Theodore Roosevelt, and then Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. He is promiscuous with his words. And I believe that words are very powerful, and especially coming from the president. And he has exploited these problems. He has exploited our divisions. And I would say it's not just Donald Trump, but also Barack Obama, and maybe throw in George W. Bush. But we have had now presidents who the biggest problem, I would say, facing America, the thing we need more than anything is someone to unite us and to bring us together and to restore a little bit of our faith. And instead of doing that, we have political leaders who, for political purposes, are intentionally stoking division.
That's true, and I'm still wrestling with how much of this is new, and you know, to the extent to which Trump is an instigator or a symptom. And you know, it became a cliche after the election that we were living in a post-truth era. But I think that people misunderstood that. It's the post-truth doesn't mean there are a lot of lies. Post-truth means the annihilation of truth. That people have no idea whether something is true and may not care about it. I mean, this is the thing, and I've many, many times quoted Garry Kasparov, who I think was also quoting Hannah Arendt, you know, that the goal of all of these lies and propaganda is not to convince you to support or oppose a specific program. It's an attack on your fundamental critical capabilities. It is to annihilate truth. It's to get you to the point where you go, what's true? I don't know. Maybe I don't care. There's no way of actually knowing. And that's a strange world, because we've always had politicians who lied. We've always had people who put out false stories. And yet right now it feels different, that you have a large portion of the public that is gullible, willing to believe the lies. But, and I'm getting where I'm going here, is that even more troubling is there seem to be people who frankly don't care that much. I mean, they know or suspect they're being lied to, but they're okay with it, because we're in this world where everything is tribal, everything is attitude, everything is identity, everything is triggering somebody. Because I mean, there's something, you know, and that's why I thought your headline was really so good. It is this, feels like this whirlpool of paranoia.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things that once it's out there, it's hard to rein in. And I think, I mean, this is really the continuation of probably something that's been going on for many centuries. And I think, you know, Christians would say that, you know, once philosophy and science started poking holes in belief in the divine, that you ended up having as a consequence of that all sorts of moral relativism. Because if there is no permanent truth that we can believe in, if there is no, you know, if there is no God, then everything is permissible.
And oh, you're channeling G.K. Chesterton, aren't you?
Yeah. And I think what we're experiencing now is maybe the secular or political version of that same unraveling.
Okay, so the Chesterton quote, and because the internet actually does have some positive aspects, Chesterton said, when men choose not to believe in God, they do not thereafter believe in nothing. They then become capable of believing in anything. That's so good.
Yeah.
That's exactly what...
I think that's true. As a Christian, I believe that's true. But I think that what we're experiencing now is maybe the next wave of that, right? Because we are like in a postmodern world, and a lot of people don't believe in God, but they did believe in Walter Cronkite. They did believe in.
You're making a distinction.
Yeah, they believed in something, right? They believed in the establishment.
Yeah,
and now was it Nietzsche said God is dead? Well, I guess the establishment is dead now.
Okay, so tell me about Berlusconi, because you make an interesting point in your column about the Italian media mogul slash prime minister and what he's associated with.
Yeah, I think this was more of an aside, but a lot of people have noted.
Asides, yeah.
Have noted that, you know, Trump isn't Mussolini, he's Berlusconi. And, you know, Italy, for all the great things about Italy, it's a very, you know, corrupt place. And I think there is a sense that America is Europe maybe delayed by 20 years. And in Italy, these conspiracy theories are very, very common. And that's kind of the point that I was making, is I do fear that we are headed toward the Europeanization of America. And this is just one, you know, you can look at what's happening in the far right and the far left and other parts of Europe, but this is just one more example.
Well, and the Italians actually have a word for it, which translates something like behindology. That okay, but the real story behind this, it infects everything. And so, you know, the Italians really love conspiracies. I mean, they're still nostalgic for the Borgias, I think. And you point out, having elected our own Berlusconi, who rose to political prominence as a birther conspiracy theorist in his own right, America is now going down the same cul-de-sac. Okay, I want to talk about other things in the news. And I suppose, you know, speaking of going down other cul-de-sacs, I want to talk about Kurt Schilling maybe running for Congress with the president's blessing, the Fredo Cuomo thing, and Ken Cuccinelli, one of the great minds now of our time, is suggesting an edit to Emma Lazarus. So I want to get your take on that, Matt Lewis, right after this. Today's podcast is brought to you by the Ultimate Sleep Machine. Look at the world's top tech leaders and high-growth startup CEOs, and I bet you wonder, how in the world they have that kind of inexhaustible energy to do what they do? And the answer might surprise you. The latest trend with top tech leaders is sleep optimization. While most Americans aren't getting the sleep they need, tech founders and CEOs are optimizing their sleep to perform at peak levels every day. The first step, the Pod by 8 Sleep, the ultimate sleep machine. The Pod is the first and only high-tech bed designed to help you achieve peak mind and body performance. So are you looking to sleep deeper? The Pod dynamically adjusts the temperature on each side of the bed so you're comfortable all night. Do you want to know your sleep intel? The Pod tracks your biometrics while you sleep with no need for wearable technology. Do you want to sleep better? Enjoy personalized programs and coaching designed by experts guiding you towards true sleep fitness. Because the better you sleep, the better you everything. Try the Pod for 100 nights, and if you don't love it, we'll refund your purchase and arrange for a free pickup, only at 8sleep.com/bulwark. Now, they already sold out their first two batches, so they're going fast. For a limited time, get $150 off your purchases. That's $150 off your purchase when you go to 8sleep.com/bulwark. That's eight sleep.com/bulwark. All right, we're back with Matt Lewis. Okay, so what do you want to start with? You want to start with Fredo and Chris Cuomo, or
yeah, that sounds like a good one.
We can work up to the really important things. Okay, again, for people who actually have lives, some troll goes up to Chris Cuomo, CNN anchor, et cetera, that are one of the Cuomo families, and refers to him as Fredo. Cuomo takes this as an anti-Italian slur, goes off on the guy. And it is kind of an epic video, isn't it? But what struck me when I was thinking about this, Matt, was that the people who posted it thought that it would really make Chris Cuomo look bad. But I don't think that's the way it's playing out.
No, I think you're probably right. And look, if I had a list of people that I would want to pick on, Chris Cuomo is pretty low on my list. For one thing, he's probably about 6'3". Teeming with testosterone. He like probably shaves during commercial breaks. And he's ripped. The guy, like, I don't know how much he could bench. So if I were looking for someone to try to corner and make one of these videos of, I don't think he would be at the top of my list.
Yeah. I mean, there's all kinds of like wimpy beta male TV personality liberal types, right? You don't go after Chris Cuomo. But
I have to say too, you know, even though I disagree with some of Chris Cuomo's political opinions, actually a super nice guy. and I'm sure you've experienced this too, Charlie, at MSNBC, that being nice or cool is very bipartisan. You know, like one of the nicest guys I ever met was Pat Buchanan at MSNBC. And there are people who are like jerks who are conservatives and people who are cool who are liberals. And I'll just give you one quick story like that will illustrate the kind of person that Cuomo is. So one time I was sitting in the green room in New York, and it was like right after New Day. So it was pretty early in the morning or maybe during a commercial break. And I was like half asleep. And Chris Cuomo kind of walks by and he looks in and he sees me and he comes up and I stand up and he comes up and he shakes my hand. And he looks me in the eye and he talks to me and asks me about my family. And then once we're sort of done, he goes over to the couch and starts talking to Leon Panetta. And then it hits me that he wanted to come in and talk to Leon Panetta. And he went through this ritual of pretend of being very nice to me. And I actually I thought that was a really cool thing of him to do because Leon Panetta is more important than me. And he could have just.
OK, this is actually an important story, because one of the things that really griped me as long as I can remember is the practice of somebody who comes up and shakes your hand, and while they're shaking your hand, their eyes are scanning the room for somebody more important or interesting. You know what I mean?
Yeah, he didn't do that at all.
Okay, and that I think is the heart of the story. No, this whole thing of I had Molly Jong Fast on yesterday, and I'm feeling a little guilty about this. I urged her, you know, not to use certain language that the people like Rick Wilson and that I use on a regular basis. So I'm trying really hard not to use the word asshole on the show today. And it is very, very unpredictable. And I'm always nervous. I'll be honest with you, as a Midwesterner, you know, meeting people that you've admired from afar and, you know, and finding out that they, in fact, are a complete jerk, right? You know, but I'm always incredibly gratified to find out how many really, really nice people they are. And I tell people, you know, it's really extraordinary, you know, how maybe it's because I spend too much time on social media that when you meet people in person, you're always thinking that they're going to be that persona on social media where everybody is awful. Everybody is awful and terrible all the time. And then you meet people in the real world and they're often very, very pleasant and they're very nice. But anyway, so interesting that Chris Cuomo, because I'll tell you, I think it's very unpredictable whether somebody's going to be a nice person or not a nice person. Now, I mean, my experience at MSNBC is the vast majority are very nice and every one of the hosts is nice. There are guests who, you know, in terms of, you know, the green room etiquette can be extremely pleasant, extremely helpful. And then there are the ones who are, shall we say, you know, in a world of their own, which we won't.
And how they treat the driver is the other. Will sound like the most like.
No.
Like
I know.
First world elitist thing to say, but like, they do provide a car sometimes. And if you want to know if someone's nice, ask the driver.
I know.
They know.
Right. No. And they will tell you. So if you really want to go first world, do you ever get those cars that actually have the air conditioned back seats?
This is one time.
Okay.
You one know time years here? Ago, I got put in like a stretch limo. It was the most uncomfortable worst.
Okay.
Possible.
We're going to get totally dragged on social media. We are going to be absolutely ridiculed. And you know what? I will particularly have it coming for asking that question. Okay. So the whole thing. So is Fredo a, you know, you are Fredo, Godfather reference. Is that an ethnic slur? Because that, frankly, that hadn't occurred to me before Cuomo sort of like, you cannot call an Italian guy Fredo. That's it.
I don't think it's an ethnic slur.
I just thought it was just a regular slur insult that you're, a, you know, a creepy, dishonest, you know, weenie guy. You know?
Yeah, no, I think they were implying that he's like the weakling of the Cuomo clan, which
he's
Eric
Trump of the Cuomos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Which is still fighting words. I mean, that's not nothing. But I'll give Cuomo a pass, and I'm admittedly biased as a CNN contributor here. But you know, look, if someone comes up, they point a camera in your face and try to pick a fight with you and call you a name. I think he's wrong about alleging it's a racial slur. But you know, he wasn't really prepared probably for this.
Yeah. Okay. So let's go to Ken Cuccinelli. So he is asked on NPR by Rachel Martin, would you also agree that Emma Lazarus's words etched in the Statue of Liberty, give me your tired, give me your poor, are also part of the American ethos? And Cuccinelli, who is the acting something or other immigration folks, it's hard to keep track of, you know, some of these guys, says they certainly are. They certainly are. Quote, give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge, he replied. That plaque was put on the Statue of Liberty at almost the same time as the first public charge was passed. Very interesting timing. So he's basically suggesting a, I don't know, an edit or a deconstructionist read on Emma Lazarus, not just give me your tired, your poor, but who can stand on their own two feet and who will not become a public charge. Matt Lewis.
Yeah, man. Let's see where to begin. So I do like Ken Cuccinelli personally. I disagree with him politically. I think, though, give him credit for being honest here. I mean, you know, they're not going to try. This is not compassionate conservatism. There's not an attempt to muddy the waters. I think what he's saying and what Trump is basically saying is that we won't that do not give us your tired and your poor. Give us your PhDs. And that's a debatable.
Give us your your super Einstein geniuses supermodels from Slovenia.
Yeah.
I mean,
give us your hot. Your
yes. Yeah. We don't want your tired and your poor, your dirty, your, you know, people with pot bellies and no money.
I mean, if I could do a good Trump impersonation, I would just riff on that. You know, believe me, nobody wants the tired of the poor. You know, give me the hot supermodel.
They're not sending their best people. They're sending their tired and their poor. I mean, what is with this? I want the energetic and the rich.
Well-educated.
Yeah, they're sending us the low-energy immigrants. Now, I think the unfortunate thing was that he actually tried to edit all of that. Because in fairness, the substantive argument is that, in fact, and he sort of blunders, sort of as an aside, you know, if you go to Ellis Island, there were a lot of restrictions on, you know, who could come in legally into this country, and that there were requirements. I don't. You're a nicer person than I am. You're saying give him credit for being honesty. I just think it was tone deaf.
Well, I mean, it's certainly not. Again, it's not the kind of. There's a type of conservatism that sort of summons us to our better angels and is optimistic and believes that you can the right to rise and you can lift people up. And they have decidedly not gone that direction. And so this is just an extension of that worldview.
So, yeah. Okay. So he actually is defending this thing. He wrote an op-ed piece saying, you know, self-sufficiency has been a core tenet of the American dream. Longstanding federal laws required foreign nationals to rely on their own capabilities and the resources of their families, sponsors, and private organizations in their communities to succeed. Yeah. So there is an interesting debate. Yeah, it is the overlay of kind of cruelty. I'm sorry to keep you overusing that, but there's this sort of, you know, this kind of this insistence on sort of cloaking yourself in a kind of insensitivity that I think makes that harder intellectual case to make. I'm sorry I interrupted you, man.
Oh, no, I interrupted you. But to me, part of it too is like, to me, if America can be a beacon of hope and a place that welcomes people, then that is actually part of American exceptionalism. That's part of why we are a great country. But as you know, Trump sees us as saps. He doesn't have a, sort of a noblesse oblige magnanimous side to him. And this is a reflection of that worldview that he's really always had.
No, that is true. You know, you should work on that riff of Donald Trump rewriting Emma Lazarus. You know, these guys were such dopes. They let in the tired, the poor, et cetera. Okay, now speaking of which, I don't want to get into Hong Kong today because this is not about foreign policy, but it is interesting to me watching some of the videos that are coming out where you have some of the protesters who are waving American flags, you know, and they're singing songs and they're looking to us as sort of this moral beacon. I have no idea what signals we're actually sending them. But that American exceptional ideal still has resonance out there in the world. And Lord knows what's going to be happening there. Okay, since we started off by talking about this, the spiral into paranoia, the weird things, there's a report now that Curt Schilling, who at one time was one of my great heroes as a pitcher, but has become a complete conspiracy theory sort of that's a nice way of actually putting it. You know, nut job is thinking of running for Congress in, was it in Arizona?
Yeah.
In Arizona with Trump's blessing. This is part of the era we're living in. It's sort of like, you know, the magnet for some of the worst political actors in America.
No, I think that's right. I was reading something the other day. It was David Petruccia's book, 1920. And there was some line in there about all the people who ran when Theodore Roosevelt ran as a Bull Moose candidate. And it was something to the effect of, like, you know, when a rising tide lifts all boats. But it was saying that, like, when the Theodore Roosevelt tide comes in, it also brings in, like, dirty socks and trash that's, like, on the bottom of the ocean. And I think that what you're having with Trump is it's been delayed. It's a lagging indicator because Trump didn't really have a coherent ideology, and he didn't really have lieutenants or a team. But slowly we are seeing a Trumpian infrastructure. We saw that with that nationalism conference that happened, an attempt to kind of retroactively graft on a sort of Trumpism, an ideological component to Trumpism. And I think we're seeing it also with the ground troops and also with the political leaders. And so, like, when people talk about Matt Schlapp possibly running in Kansas, or now Schilling, that this is part of it, that this is how Trumpism actually could outlast Trump.
Yeah, it is. And of course, we're not going to go into the radicalization of Kurt Schilling. I mean, he got fired for his anti-LGBT comments, for demonizing Muslims. I mean, he really had gone off the rails on all of this.
And it's too bad, because, as you noted, I mean, the guy, really heroic.
Oh, the bloody sock. There. That's an iconic bite baseball.
The bloody sock, absolutely. Yeah. And he could have been, I mean, nobody says he has to become a liberal and run in Massachusetts. He could have been a conservative who got elected in Arizona.
He's running in Arizona. I mean, that's the thing, is that I actually had to look up this, because he had apparently at one time floated the idea that he was running against Elizabeth Warren. Okay, because I know that I'm contradicting myself, because I've made the case not to spend time talking about Anthony Scaramucci, but I wanted to get your take on Anthony Scaramucci, who is having his road to Damascus, right? Oh my goodness, you know, like 5 minutes ago, I was on television sucking up to Donald Trump, saying that I would be his sycophantic spokesman, and now it's like, now I recognize that he's incapable and we may need to dump him. So your take on Scaramucci and why?
My take is the old sort of saw about how I'm willing to welcome a whore into the church, but I don't think she should be, like, teaching Sunday school the first week or in the choir, like, immediately.
She can play the piano.
Yeah, I mean, like, Anthony Scaramucci, look, we should be about converts, and we should be welcoming converts in, people who want to, you know, stand up for conservatism but against Trumpism. Like, let's welcome them in, but, like, to immediately put them on TV and make them kind of an intellectual leader of the, you know, I don't want to say
no.
Resistance, but of never Trumpism. I just think it's a bit much.
It is a bit much, and the speed with which he flipped around is, I don't know. It just he's one of those people who has been brought into American politics that would normally not have been allowed. I mean, who would take him seriously? What is the point?
Yeah.
But there is going to be this trickle trip, you know, drip 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 over the next 4 or 5 years of people who had been, you know, loyalists, but now are going, you know, I knew all along. Or don't blame me for that. You know that there's going to be, you know, people will begin flaking off, particularly if there is not electoral success.
Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, presidents always bring new people into the fold. I mean, Bill Clinton, because of Bill Clinton, there was all sorts of Arkansas people that would have never made it in the big time. And then of course, you have people like James Carville, who became, like, superstars. And I mean, with Bush, I mean, nobody would have known who Karen Hughes was outside of Houston, probably, if it wasn't for Bush. There are all sorts of, like, Texans. With Trump, it's not necessarily, like, loyalists who supported him like regionally. It's people like Omarosa.
Yeah. I was actually thinking of her when we were talking about this. Yeah.
Yeah. So there are people, but it is a different type of person that normally wouldn't have made it to the show on their merits.
No, you're right. And I was actually thinking of that 5 minutes when everybody was taking Omarosa seriously until they realized that she was Omarosa. Okay, so the flip side of this, and this goes back to your previous column, because see, this is a great segue. The flip side are the number of people who have been driven out of the party. And you and I haven't talked since Will Hurd announced that he was not running for re-election, the latest Republican to basically say, "Yeah, I am out of here." And you described that as devastating. So what was so devastating about Texas Congressman Will Hurd basically saying, "Hey, you know, I'm out of here, I'm done"?
Well, I mean, here's a guy who's, you know, he's really so obviously he's African American. He represents a very Hispanic district in Texas. He is a former, you know, intelligence officer, highly qualified expert on cybersecurity, very smart, thoughtful conservative, not a Trumpian conservative, but like a mainstream kind of Reagan conservative. This is the type of person that you would normally think should be a rising star in a political
party. And he
party.
Was, right? And I mean, was. This was the guy that people said, this is the future of the Republican Party. This is the rising star. You know, when Paul Ryan was speaker, his staff said, this is our favorite guy. And now he's out.
There's this line that I like to quote from Hayek, where he talks about how in a totalitarian regime that the worst get to the top. And it really does make sense. And it's not even, I mean, look, it obviously is true of a totalitarian regime. In Russia, you end up with people like Stalin outmaneuvering Bukharin and others. But it's not just totalitarian regimes. I would say it's even just like dysfunctional offices. You've probably worked at some point in your life in a dysfunctional office where really talented, good people end up leaving, being pushed out. And the people who end up their bosses are actually very mediocre people who are never going to leave, never going to move on. And that's very toxic for any institution, any organization. And I think that's kind of where the Republican Party is right now. If you're someone like Will Hurd, you are not going to rise. You're going to be purged. You're going to be pushed out. The people who do rise to the top are, as Hayek said, the worst get to the top.
And there's a generational component to all of that, that if, in fact, you are driving out your, you know, many of the best and the brightest young people who used to be your future, then this is going to be something that's going to play out over a very long period of time for the Republican Party, a Republican Party in which you have, the Corey Lewandowskis and the Kurt Schillings are rising and the Will Hurds and the Paul Ryans are headed for the exit. That is an historically existential problem for a political party.
You're exactly right. And if you think about it, this is like a football team, like a sports team. It's like a business. This is a corporate culture problem. The Republican Party has a culture problem, and this could last for a generation. And if you think about it, someone who comes in, like say a new football coach, a new general manager, sometimes what they'll have to do is basically, you know, burn the team down and start over from scratch and change the culture, because some of those veterans now have been inculcated with bad values. They are going to actually scare off talented young people. That's where we are right now, I think, in the Republican Party, a very bad, toxic culture.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping to end on a high note, but that is the truth. There's no question about it. So give me a hot take for today. Give me your hot take.
Oh man!
They call you up on CNN and they say, "Okay, Matt, we need a guy with some hot takes."
Well, okay.
What do you got?
I don't know how much of a hot. Okay, here it's not a hot take, but I think it's a take. So I saw like Sarah Silverman, the other day was on Bill Simmons' podcast, and she mentioned that she had gotten fired from her role because, like a decade ago, she appeared in a skit wearing blackface, and I saw a lot of conservatives kind of being gleeful, having some schadenfreude about this and like, hey, now you get a taste of your own medicine. And look, I get it. She's a lefty. But I think actually what we should be doing is making allies of people like Sarah Silverman, if possible. Like, the more people like Sarah Silverman and Bill Simmons and Chris Rock, and a lot of these people are comedians, like Jerry Seinfeld, like, the more of these people who realize the danger of cancel culture, then the better. And instead of like pushing them away by making fun of them, let's say like, hey, I'm glad Sarah Silverman realizes now that, like, number one, we should have, like, people can do stupid things, and there can be, like, eventually some sort of forgiveness for it. Like, I don't know. I just feel like the attempt to, like, make fun of her actually could have negative, like.
No, right. Because this is really a teachable moment. You know, this is the moment where you say, okay, this is what we've been talking about. We have been warning against this, not because we are racist or we are sexist or we think that the blackface is completely acceptable. We're warning about this because this sort of, you know, nihilistic, you know, cancel culture, you know, is going to destroy, you know, people for making, you know, mistakes a decade ago.
Right. I mean, but if we make fun of her and push her away, then she goes back to the left and basically bows down and apologizes and tries to, like, pay indulgences. But if we could win over people like Sarah Silverman, and I don't think she's going to become pro-life. I don't think she's going to become, you know, an anti-tax warrior. But if we could win over people like her, and I think Bill Maher is actually, it's funny, I was on Bill Maher's show with Sarah Silverman. So, but I think Bill Maher is kind of there right now. It's good for the conservative movement and for the cause of freedom when we have people like Bill Maher who are defending, you know, the right to free speech and the right to for tolerance and diverse opinions and for forgiveness for people who do stupid things.
No, I think one of the funniest, most trenchant analyses of political correctness in this whole culture of microaggressions was Aziz Ansari, who has, you know, went through his own near-death experience involving the Me Too movement, you know, and I think learned something about it. And if you have a chance, is he back on, is it an HBO, is it Net?
It's Netflix.
I was going to say HBO. Netflix. You know, he's not a conservative. He's not going to be, you know, a right-winger, but his new perspective is valuable, and you're absolutely right. Don't mock him, don't push him away, you know, particularly given the moment we're at right now. We need all of these allies that we possibly can get.
Like, they're not going to become little Ronald Reagans, but they could become Joe Rogan or you know, something, you know, Aziz Ansari. I mean, they could become potential allies in this one part of the culture. I hate to say culture war, but in this correctness run amok, and that's helpful.
Okay, see, that was an outstanding hot take. I am glad I asked you, Matt Lewis. Thanks for joining us again on the podcast. Appreciate it very, very much.
I think you and I have just written my next column, Charlie.
You have written it. I just teed it up for you. We'll have you back on. And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast, which was brought to you today by 8 Sleep. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.